forum for frank talk about what people do for a living. Works do.
And welcome to Work Stew. It's October 10th, 2013, and this is episode number 69. I'm Kate Gase Walton. I'm the editor of Work Stew, an online collection of essays and interviews in which people ponder their work lives. In this episode, I speak with Liesl Clark and Rebecca Rockefeller, co-founders of the Buy Nothing Project. Usually, I interview people about the work they do to make a living, but Work Stew has never been about work in the narrowest sense. What I'm most interested in exploring is simply why people do what they do. Seated around Rebecca's kitchen table, with birds and children chirping in the background, we discussed just that. I started by asking how the Buy Nothing movement got going.
I would say it started on the beach.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the beginning, in that we discovered a lot of plastic washing up with every high tide onto our local beaches, whether, you know, it was a beach right down the street from where we live or out on the Pacific Ocean and the Olympic Peninsula. Just washing up. Every single wave has plastic in it. And we collected it and inventoried the plastics and did a project with our children who were being homeschooled, both of our families together. And we found that through our own investigations and listing out each item, we found that really this plastic isn't from people who are walking on the beaches or who are in their boats, that it's actually coming from our homes and not from just seaside activity. It's washing down through the watersheds from our backyards, from our cars in parking lots, just because plastic exists. So how does that translate itself into a buy nothing movement? Well, we feel that, I mean, part of the problem is that most of these plastics are single-use plastics. They're not all single-use plastics, but they're items that are commonly bought every day by people, and they slough off of wherever you are in your vehicle or from your home, and they break down into tinier and tinier little bits. And we just have figured that there's just too much of it on the planet, and manufacturers are outproducing our ability to keep up with it and dispose of it sustainably. So it's ending up everywhere. We find it in the highest watersheds in Nepal. We find it at sea level here. We find it in the gyres, but it's truly here to stay. And we just figured, what if we literally had a model where we tried to see if we could buy less and rely on our local economies, our local neighbors, and ask for what we need and give what we have to each other and keep the material economy circulating within itself and not bring in new feedstock, not bring in new plastics.
So what was the first thing you did, or some of the first few things that you did to make that a reality?
Well, one morning I woke up and I said, that's it. I called Liesl. I'm doing it. I'm going to set up this group on Facebook. Like, I think we're just going to do it and see as an experiment what happens. And we set it up. I set up this group for Bainbridge and specifically picked Facebook because it's a free platform that a lot of people on the island are already using. And I really wanted to give people the ability to see each other and to see who they have as mutual friends, so that even if I am a complete stranger to you, I can see we have 34 mutual friends, mm-hmm. and they're good people. And, you know, I'm going to trust that you are as well, because there's this real life connection there. And I wanted to give people the chance to talk to each other about stuff, because the thing that Liesl and I know about stuff after spending years literally pulling these pieces off of the beach and trying to figure out what they were and where they came from is that all of these items have stories, and that is the most compelling thing about them. And if we're going to change people's desires for things, we need to give them something better than just stuff. Right now, we're trained, especially in this country, to consume things rapaciously. Like, we want more. More is what's better. More is what you're going to judge me by. I need the newer lawnmower. I need that new jacket. I need the right shoes. I need all of these things. They have to be new. They have to turn over, and they're built like pieces of junk. They fall apart. It's okay. It doesn't matter to me because I'm buying more. I'm buying what's new. I need to get it all. And we think that that's filling this hole that we each have inside of ourselves that is, of course, not. It's this empty pursuit of material goods. I mean, you know, there are tons of songs and movies about it. This isn't news to anybody, but it's how do we make people want used things? How do you make Americans, especially upper middle class Americans, want used things when they can buy whatever they want? And the way you do it is with narrative, with a connection to the story. If I know that your vase that you're offering up came from some crotchety aunt who you hated and you just want it out of your house, and it's this beautiful vase, but every time you look at it, all you can hear is her voice, you know, telling you that you were a loser. And I think that is like, that's really funny. Like, I can relate. I have a crotchety aunt too. Like, and I'm going to do you a favor and take this vase. And now every time I put it on my table, I'm not going to hear that crotchety aunt's voice that you hear. I'm going to be laughing because it's so funny to me. Or, I mean, and that's like, there are funny stories like that. There are poignant stories. There are really meaningful stories to all of this stuff. And when we put, when we give people this transparent platform where they can share those stories, and then where you can see that I'm not the only person who wants that vase, 23 other people want it. There's this amazing social proof that we're leveraging to create desire for used things, because truly they are more desirable when they have, when they come with a connection to a community, when they come with a narrative, when you're part of that narrative. And then, you know, like, when you're done with this vase, I can, when I'm done with it, I can offer it up and some, and then I'll be able to say, I got it from Kate and it came with this story and here's what I've done with it. And, you know, for 5 years we've had it full of, you know, birthday bouquets on my table, and that's what we use it for. But now it's time for us to move it to somebody else. And so suddenly it has like another chapter to it, and it becomes this sort of community heirloom that moves on. And if, I mean, we're doing that with things from, I mean, one of the very first things that was, that someone requested on the Bainbridge group, which was our first Buy Nothing Project group, was a toilet paper spring thing. There's probably a name for it. We don't even know what it's called. Right. And it was like, I started this group, and before I could even post an offer or a request, I was not even done setting it up. There were like 100 people in there, and someone had asked for a toilet paper spring thing. Like, this sounds really crazy, but this is what I need. And I think it was like 5 or 10 minutes later, and they had two.
It materialized.
Two of them. Wow. Not just one, but two people had this random object in their house, and everyone was just very... I mean, like, just everyone thought it was really funny, and it was, it set the tone for, like, this is really funny, and now these two people who don't know each other are connecting over a toilet paper spring, which is the most ridiculous of objects, and it's, everyone is amused.
But we would normally buy something like that,
and it's such a
dehumanizing sort of, I mean, it's just an item that you wouldn't think that you'd bond with somebody else over. But the point is, and it's not just about used stuff, that some of our stuff is just broken and it's missing one little piece. Well, those one little pieces so often are being found within, if you have a group of even 50 people, you're going to find that little thing. And I'm convinced that there's almost nothing that hasn't truly materialized for someone. And it's becoming almost a community challenge. When somebody asks for something, it's almost like you can hear the scurrying, the scurrying going on in people's closets. And then a few minutes later, somebody pops back on and says, I found one. And they want to be the first because it's such a pleasure. I call it infectious. It's called infectious giving.
Yeah.
Because the more you see other people meeting other people's needs, the more you want to be a part of that because it is a true dopamine hit. It's like the most natural high that you can be on is being a part of a giving economy.
The Buy Nothing Project, was that a kind of broader movement that existed that you guys plugged into, or was that your doing?
That was our doing. It's our name that we came up with. There is a Buy Nothing Day, which I guess is the day after Thanksgiving. And it's quite popular internationally. And so we didn't even really know about the Buy Nothing Day. I think it was somewhere in the recesses of our minds. But we have a project that we started called Trash Backwards, where we've taken about 4,000 items, and we have solutions for each item on how to basically reduce it, reuse it, recycle it, refuse it. Mm-hmm. And Buy Nothing is literally the refuse side of it, which is the front side of the three R's, is to refuse and reduce. If you can refuse and reduce in the first place, you know, not even buy it, not even consume it, so to speak, or come up with an alternative to it, then, you know, I feel like we're on our way to solving this problem of too much plastic choking up our watersheds. So that's really where Buy Nothing is the nugget at the core of that mission of reducing.
Yeah. And now you have it going in some other communities too, right?
We have 23 Buy Nothing projects.
So has there been any backlash, is probably too strong a word, but you know, the other campaign that we see a lot of here on Bainbridge is the Buy Local, right? And this message that it's really important to the local economy to go to our local shops. So has anybody said, hey, you guys are ruining this for our local merchants?
All of us participate in the cash economy. And some of us, if you're lucky enough, you have a local gift economy you can participate in. And I think that they do, they're run parallel to each other. And to think that you can excuse yourself from the cash economy completely in this country is a pretty crazy idea. Right. I know that there are people who try that, but that's really extreme.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a fair expectation or even a sensible one.
Right.
I mean, there's a reason we have cash and it serves a really useful purpose in some cases. But to me, one of the ulterior motives to sort of the Buy Nothing project is if we didn't have to spend money on silly things like toilet paper springs and kids' Halloween costumes, that frees up some of our cash. And we're more likely, when we have some of the burden taken off of our spending, to be able to buy things that normally we might not be able to afford. And I think it's pretty common for local goods to be more expensive than mass-produced goods. And so if you have somebody who's able to participate in a Buy Nothing project group and take some of, sort of free up some cash, and to be able to go to the farmer's market and buy local produce instead of having to go to the Safeway and buy shipped-in produce from California, then that's actually not just in parallel, we're actually benefiting the local economy, the local cash economy as well.
What I would love to end with is if each of you have one favorite story of something that has happened so far, is there anything that springs to mind? I know there's so many that it's hard.
Well, this story, I guess, and Rebecca can chime in too. I mean, it shows you how giving can be not only infectious, but it ends up being cyclical, where you might receive a gift like picking pears from someone's trees. That's a gift to be able to go and pick their organic, beautiful pears. And then that turns into, well, maybe this isn't a good example.
No, I think
and
in then, a way it is.
Because then he gets to know that person and he sees that there's some wool on her porch, and she tells him a story of how she's been wanting to give it away, but the people never came to pick it up. And I guess he received the pears, and he then actually just gave a gift of some blackberry wine in exchange, but then the blackberry wine exploded, and so it was sort of gifting gone bad. Right. And then there's attendant guilt that comes with it. But he knew that there was wool that she wanted to get rid of, so then he offered to get rid of the wool for her, but the wool had wasps in it. And so then he asked the community to please help him to rid the wool of the wasps.
But he asked when he already had the wool wrapped in tarps on the back of his car,
so he had a car full of wasps,
yeah. Which it just astounds me how he actually managed to do that without getting stung, but he did. And so it was the best request I've ever seen in terms of like, okay, so you're not going to believe this, but I have the trunk of my car is full of wasps living in wool, and they're wrapped in a tarp, but I'm not sure what to do with them. And I'm not sure, are they honeybees? Are they yellow jackets? I don't know. They're something, and they're living, they're buzzing, and they're not happy anymore. And so the whole community sprang into action to figure out how to help this man, Jeff, get these wasps out of the back of his car.
He drove his car, and it worked. To my house, and I'm a beekeeper, so I have bee suits, and I selfishly wanted the honeybees if they were honeybees, the ultimate gift for me. And he unraveled the burrito tarp full of bees and wasps, and we found that, no, they're not honeybees, they are wasps. And of course the bee suits were standing nearby, but they were quite docile, so they weren't really an issue. So he was able to, because I was filming him extract a good half of the wool so that the person who wanted the wool could get the wool. And then he was able to dump the rest of the wool and wasps in the forest, which, you know, it's all organic. But I think we'll end up getting the wool. We'll retrieve it. I think the wasps aren't going to stick around. They'll move on. So everything is being saved and cherished. But it was a remarkable day,
though, having, you know, pears and wine and wool and wasps. By the end of it, it was scores of people involved on that thread.
Exactly.
And, I mean, if there's anything that people might read to get a flavor of what can happen when you connect over a few objects, that was certainly one example, right?
It's a perfect example.
And there are many others, but we should wrap up and I'll get my kids out of your house.
Well, no, it's lovely.
But thank you both for talking to me. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
That wraps up the interview for today. Thanks again very much to my guests, Liesl Clark and Rebecca Rockefeller. Thanks also to everyone who's written an essay for Work Stew. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening today. The next episode, which will very likely be both bird and child free, will be released in 2 weeks, and I hope you'll check it out. In the meantime, please let me know what you thought of the interview by sending an email to kate@workstew.com, by posting a comment on the Work Stew website, or by writing a review for iTunes. Thanks again, and bye for now.